copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
My name is Andreas. I'm from Germany. I'm an ancient historian, as you may have guessed from my topic. And I'm teaching at the Helmut Schmidt Universität in Hamburg. And I also used to work for Jürgen Spies, the Institute for Glaube und Wissenschaft, the Institute for Science and Faith. You may have heard about that. I think they're pretty well known at ELF. And what I intend to do today is to have a close look at the Christmas story in Luke chapter 2 through the glasses of a Roman historian. And I want to ask the question, is Luke, like John Lennon said, a good historian? Does he know what he's doing, and does he present us a believable and reliable picture of the events around Christmas? As far as I can get as a historian, there are certain limits to my tools. I came to this topic during my times when I was studying in Erlangen, ancient history, and we had a Christmas celebration at the chair of ancient history, and I had just finished my Greek class, and one of my professors asked me, Andreas, you just did your Greek exam, could you just read the Christmas story in Greek for us? And I did that for the first time in Greek, and I was so surprised how familiar that sounded. A Roman emperor, a Roman governor, a registration for taxation. That's my world. And I realized, okay, the New Testament is not that far away from what I'm doing. And ever since then, I was fascinated by this story. I soon found out that a lot of the story is controversial in scholarship. There's hardly any part of it which has not been deconstructed by one scholar or another. So that in the end, hardly anything is left standing. And I thought, that's not my impression when I read that. When I'm reading Suetonius or Tacitus, Roman historians, and I'm reading Luke, he's not that bad of a historian. My impression is he's quite good at what he's doing, and I wanted to look deeper into that. And when I worked for Jürgen Spies, I had the chance to do that for half a year, to do an intense study, and all in all it took me 1.5 years to finish that, and I have published my results in 3 scholarly papers and a popular booklet, all of it in German, unfortunately. And I'm now trying to summarize that for you in the next roughly 40 minutes or so. What can I offer you as an ancient historian, as a secular historian? I'm not a theologian, and I do not want to look at the text as a Christian believer. I am a Christian believer, but I want to look at it as a secular historian with my tools and my methods, the ones I have. So how do historians work? That's the first question I want to answer, and I hope I had to improvise a bit with technique. Okay, that's too far. Yeah, what do historians do? We're trying to understand our ancient authors, our sources. And we do that with a method called historical criticism. Now, I know the term criticism and critics is a bit problematic. When applied to the Bible. As a historian, I do not want to be skeptical. I do not want to treat my sources badly with a highly skeptical presupposition. Criticism just means analysis. I want to look at them closely, carefully. I want to read them in their own time, their own culture, their own context. But I do not want to treat them unfairly. The burden of proof is on me, the historian, not on the source. That's quite important. And I want to understand what an ancient author is saying according to his own intention. So I do not want to read my own hobby horses into the text. I want to find out what does he want to communicate to me as a reader. In that sense, we are somewhat old-fashioned. We're not postmodernists, and we do not believe that we as readers constitute the meaning of a text, but the author does. When we are reading a source which claims to present historical information, what has happened at a certain point of time, we try to do something more. We try to weigh the plausibility and probability of what the guy was writing, in this case, Luke. And it's always that we do not have foolproof case. We never have that. We know mathematicians. We can just weigh the evidence, like a judge or a jury. I have to look. Yeah. One way we do that is by a standardized methodology. So we do ask certain questions. We do ask who wrote it, who's the author, how close was he to the events he's describing. In time, in space, geographically, in substance, was he an eyewitness, for example? Or was he living in a quite different area 100 years later? That's the difference. What kind of genre is he using? Is he writing history, or is he writing poetry, or is he writing a letter? That makes a difference on how we read that kind of literature. We're also asking what kind of sources did he use, the ancient historian? Had Luke proper sources, reliable sources, which could tell him about Jesus and what he did and said? And what kind of methods did he use? Different ancient historians used different methods. Some of them were quite good, almost modern. Others were quite fanciful, and what they wrote is more a novel, like proper history. So what kind of methodology is Luke using? And we are comparing what he has written with parallel traditions. In that case, for example, Mark's Gospel or Matthew's Gospel or John's Gospel. And also with other reports about the same events or the same circumstances. Is there kind of an analogy? Can I compare things? Do we have multiple attestation for certain events and for certain things? And we're trying to ask whether his narrative is coherent. Does it make sense the way he's telling the story? Or is he contradicting himself at certain points? That's also an important question. But that's not all to historical work. There is another point as well. You might call it the creative aspect of the historian's work. We cannot do everything by pure methodology. When you're reading ancient texts, and you've been doing that for 10 years, and you've been reading Polybios or Livy or Suetonius for years and years and years, you're getting familiar with that guy and his writing. It's like being in communication to my wife. I'm getting to know her more and more and more every year of our marriage. And there is a moment she doesn't have to say anything. I know what she wants. I know what she thinks just by looking at her. And it's a bit of the same when you're dealing with ancient authors or ancient cultures. The more you study them and the more you learn about them, the more you learn to understand them. And one of my students asked me 2 weeks ago what I think about a certain passage in a certain ancient historian. I think it was Polybios. And I haven't read this passage before. I didn't know it, but I knew quite a bit of Polybios. I was able to say, okay, I don't know the passage, but if you ask me, it has to be understood this and that way, roughly. And we checked it, and was right. This kind of familiarity with the time, the circumstances, the culture, the social context, and my authors is also part of what it means to work as a historian. And you cannot completely rationalize that in a proper methodology. So it's part of both. We have rules, we have methods, but we also have kind of an instinct based on familiarity with our sources and our time. And both of it is important. In the end, all we can do is, as I said, weighing the evidence. We're doing kind of a trial. We are judge and jury. We have mostly circumstantial evidence. We hardly have any kind of perfect proof for anything, not in antiquity. Very rarely we have an artifact or an inscription which almost proves something beyond doubt, but that's very rare. Most of the time we're trying to weigh the probabilities and plausibilities. And we are heavily dependent on our ancient sources in quantity and in quality. For some periods, we have a lot of sources and pretty good ones. And we know a lot about this time and this period and the people active there. For other periods, we have hardly any sources or pretty bad ones, if at all. And we have to do a lot of guesswork to know anything at all. And it's very shaky and very unstable. So there are different levels of certainty we can reach depending on our sources. That will also be important. In the end, it's kind of a detective work. You're puzzling together your sources and trying to paint a comprehensive picture of the time you're dealing with based on your sources and based on what you know. And parts of it you can extrapolate or guess. But only parts of it. Working with a gospel like Luke's gospel as an ancient historian has certain consequences. On the one hand, I cannot give Luke any kind of preferential treatment when I'm working as a secular historian. Just because Luke is Holy Scripture, which I believe as a Christian, does not mean I can say, okay, he has to be right in anything he claims. Not on a technical level as a historian. That doesn't work so. And I will also not offer you a full theological interpretation of the text. There is much more to this text than I'm going to discuss today. Much, much more. I'm just looking at the history. But Luke has also a message he's trying to convey based on this history he's telling. So a proper theologian has to do more than just a bit historical research. I'm doing just Hilfswissenschaft. I'm trying to aid theology as far as I can get. On the other hand, that's also important, I must not treat Luke with a negative bias just because he's part of Holy Scripture. Just because this book, the Gospel of Luke, was integrated into a collection of Christian writings after it was written, does not mean that I have to treat it as highly suspicious and potentially ill-leading. No, it's a source. It's an ancient historian who's writing history, and I have to treat him as positively as any other ancient author too. So no negative bias. All sources are a priori equal, first and foremost. And then we're going to look at them and to compare them. And the third point is, I know that my historical approach has limits. There are stuff I can't do and I can't talk about. I still think it has a lot of value for theology. If, and now I'm speaking as a Christian, not as a historian as such, if God became a human being in Jesus Christ, if that really is true, and I believe this to be true, then God entered human history. And he made himself knowable through history. We can follow his footsteps. He left traces for us to discover. He became a regular human being, Jesus of Nazareth. And looking at him and following his traces throughout history may not be everything I can say about Jesus. There is much more. He's God's son. And he died for our sins and was raised for our justification. That's all true. But as far as I can get as a historian, until those limits my methods just posing me, I think I can know a lot about him and help understanding him properly and rightfully in what he says and what he does. So doing historical work with the Gospels, with the New Testament, with Jesus, is just taking the incarnation highly seriously, in my view. That's why I'm doing that. And why I think it's so important not to forget about history. So that's kind of the prolegomena, what I had to say before. I'm going to address my topic at hand. When we are now trying to address the text at hand, Luke 2 verses 1 through 7. And I've given you two English translations and a transliteration of the Greek text in the source paper. What is the problem? I mean, has anyone the text with you? Can anyone read the text aloud in translation? handout or Bible.
The whole text?
Yeah, verses 1 through 7.
In those days, Caesar Augustus issued a decree that a census should be taken of the entire Roman world. This was the first census that took place while Quirinius was governor of Syria. And everyone went to their own town to register. So Joseph also went up from the town of Nazareth in Galilee to Judea, to Bethlehem, the town of David, because he belonged to the house and line of David. He went there to register with Mary, who was pledged to be married to him and was expecting a child. While they were there, the time came for the baby to be born, and she gave birth to her firstborn, a son. She wrapped him in cloths and placed him in a manger, because there was no guest room available for them.
Okay, thank you. A brief text, and on the first sight, a very clear text. Which does not seem to pose any serious problems at all. I mean, it's easy to understand on first sight. What are the problems? Why is there so much discussion in scholarship? I've given you 5 points based on the work of a German scholar, Emil Schürer, from the early 20th century. These points were repeated in the second edition of his works in 1973, a reworked edition by English scholars. And they're still very, very influential. That's basically still today the basis for questioning this text in Luke. And he makes 5 points and says, we do not know, over against verse 1, about any kind of general imperial changes in that age. Secondly, what we know about the Roman changes, they would not have been obliged to travel to Bethlehem. They could have stayed in Nazareth, where they lived, Joseph and Mary, both of them. Then at that time, Herod was king of Judea, and Schürer claims he was a more or less independent ruler, so the Roman emperor would not do a census in his kingdom. It's impossible. And Josephus, the famous Jewish, and rightly so, famous Jewish historian, knows nothing about a Roman census in Palestine before the notorious one, an important one, under Quirinius in AD 6 and 7, which is way too late when Jesus was born under King Herod. And Quirinius simply was not Roman governor of Syria when Herod was king in Judea. So 5 points why Luke was mostly wrong in this brief text. You can summarize these points a bit more closely. 3 problems: the census, Quirinius, and the journey to Bethlehem. Was there a worldwide, that is, empire-wide for a Roman, the empire was the whole world which counted, registration? Was Quirinius anywhere near Judea when Jesus was born? And were they supposed to go to Bethlehem for a census when they were obviously living in Nazareth? These are the 3 questions I'm going to address. I can tell you beforehand that question 1 and 3 are pretty easy to answer. I think here Luke does everything right. Question 2 is way more problematic, and here I can just offer some options for dealing with it. I do not have a definite answer to it. It is quite difficult and tricky. So, the problem at hand is that in Matthew 2, Jesus is born when Herod was king of Judea. And in Luke 1:5, it also says Herod was king of Judea when John the Baptist was born, and that is connected very closely to the birth of Jesus. So apparently Jesus was born under King Herod in Matthew and in Luke. But then Josephus tells us that Quirinius was governor of Syria in AD 6, and Herod died in 4 BC, 10 years earlier. So if the problem is, if Jesus was born under King Herod, he cannot have been born under Quirinius on this reading. And if he was born under Quirinius, he cannot have been born under King Herod. That's the tricky thing, and that's the question to answer when we're talking about this Roman official here. There are different possibilities how to address such a problem. I'm usually discussing them with my students in the introduction class to ancient history, and we do have basically three options. One option is we do have sources which tell us stuff about different events. They sound similar, but they are distinct, and so there is no contradiction. The second option is we have sources which do tell about the same event, but in a complementary way. They're emphasizing different aspects, and you can read them together. And the third option is they are so contradictory, one is wrong, and you have to drop at least one source as not being reliable. When we transfer this on our question, we could argue that Josephus is right, then Jesus could not be born under Herod and Quirinius, and so either Matthew or Luke are wrong, and scholarship says probably Luke, with his dating under Quirinius. Or we could say maybe Josephus is wrong. Why not? It's just an ancient source, an ancient author. He could be wrong too. It's not just Luke who must necessarily be wrong. Then Jesus could have been born under Herod and Quirinius, and Matthew and Luke could both be right. It's an option. We have to look at that. Or a third option, we are wrong. Our assessment of the evidence is wrong. We have misread Luke or misread Josephus or Matthew, and we need to reread our sources in order to find out whether we have done them injustice by just misreading them. Now, the interesting question is, can we expect an evangelist like Luke to be right? Can we expect him to present us with reliable historical information? He's preaching the gospel in his text. I mean, isn't that enough? And if you're talking to some New Testament scholars, they will say, yes, that's enough. It's just theology. He's just preaching. He doesn't want to write history in any proper sense of the word. So at first, I want to give you some reasons why I think we can expect Luke to give us proper, correct information, and why I think he is A, historian, and B, a good one. The first point, in the introduction to his gospel, chapter 1, verses 1 through 4, he's writing a kind of an introduction which is typical for ancient historians to write. He tells about his aims, his sources, and about his methods. And by doing this, he's placing himself in this kind of tradition of good ancient historiography. He wants to be taken serious as a historian, and I want to be a polite colleague and take him seriously. I want to be taken seriously too by my colleagues. So it's just a question of historical politeness to take an ancient colleague seriously too, if he wants to be taken seriously, and Luke does. Second point is, Luke knows Roman institutions very, very well. In the second part of the book of Acts, when Paul is traveling throughout the Roman Empire, the eastern part of the Roman Empire, Luke tells us how Paul is visiting different provinces, different cities. He's meeting Roman governors of different kinds, city officials. At that time, there were different kinds of provinces with different kinds of governors. They had different titles. Different cities had different laws, different magistrates. They had different names. Wherever we can check Luke, he's right. Wherever we have mostly inscriptional evidence to know how a certain official in Ephesus or in Philippi or in Thessalonica or Corinth was named, Luke gets it right. And that's a pretty impressive evidence for Luc being a good historian. Most ancient historians didn't bother a lot about administration, about titles, about offices. It was boring for them. Josephus gets the titles of the Roman governors of Syria wrong very often. He just wasn't interested in that. He gave them all kinds of titles and job descriptions, but just in a few cases, the proper ones. I mean, he was writing Greek, and they had Roman, Latin titles, but there were proper translations for them. Luke is almost a bit tight in this, but it's important to him to be precise, and he has the knowledge to be precise. And that alone makes me quite impressed by what he knows and how precise he wants to work and to be as a historian. That does not mean that he has to be right in Luke 2. After all, when he's writing about these events in Acts, he was an eyewitness in part of them. He was with Paul in a certain point. And depending on how you date the book of Acts, 90s, 70s, 60s, I do prefer the 60s, but I don't care at that point. He was about 20 to 40 years away from the events. In case of the birth of Jesus, he was 60 to 80 years away from the events. And he was an eyewitness. He wasn't there. He had to ask people. He had to look for sources. So he himself had a very different source basis for what he was doing in Luke and what he was doing in Acts. But this evidence alone pushes me towards expecting Luke to be right on at least at many points. As a third point, when we compare the first half of Acts and the second half of Acts, we find out that in the second part, where he was a travel companion of Paul, and when he had good knowledge, he's very detailed. He tells you about certain events, about times and places, about names of people involved, in part on a daily basis. So when he knows a lot, he likes to present a lot of his knowledge. He delights in giving you a lot of information. The first 12 chapters of Acts, where he himself was quite removed from the events, the early history of the church in the 30s. Yes, he knows some stuff. He tells us stories about Peter, about the Jerusalem church, but he's rather imprecise. There's hardly a concrete and proper date. It's after a couple of days, after this time. He names very little names except Peter, Paul, and John. And he's by far not as precise and detailed as in the second half of his book. For me, that shows that he doesn't just make things up. When he has good information, he gives us a lot of good information. When he has no good information, he's content to present what he's got, but he doesn't make it up. It would have been easy for him just to invent a few names, a few dates, a few places. He doesn't do that. Again, that's something which I think is impressive about Luke in terms of how he does his job as a historian. And then, very briefly, I'm quite convinced that Luke Acts is the work of a companion of Paul that was quite unpopular in parts of scholarship in the 20th century. It's coming back now, even in Germany. There are some more and more scholars who think it was actually Luke who wrote that. I'm convinced that it's true. Whether he wrote his books in the 60s, which I think is right, or in the 70s, or in the 80s, doesn't matter much. He was quite close to the events in any case. And if we want to know when he learned about Jesus and his childhood, in AD 57, he went with Paul to Jerusalem to meet James the Just, the brother of Jesus. That's a perfect time to talk to James and to talk to members of the Jerusalem church, friends of Jesus, of his family, maybe even some other brothers of Jesus. Who knows? But I'm quite convinced that this is the point where he got his information from. And that's just the late 50s. That's not in the 80s or 90s when he might have been written. And he had the family of Jesus to talk to, and his earliest followers in Jerusalem. So he's got access to very good sources himself. The German scholar Rainer Riesner, heavily influenced by a Swedish school of thought, even argued that the special material of Luke, that is the stories which are only in Luke and nowhere else, not in Mark and not in Matthew, can be traced back to the very, very earliest forms of Jewish Christian traditions, possibly even to Jesus' family around James and others. And the birth stories are part of this Lucan special material. So this would even strengthen the case that Luke got his stories from Jesus' closest friends and relatives from very early on. And a final point, Luke knows about this other census, the one in AD 6. He mentions it in the book of Acts. He even correlates it with a certain Judas who made an insurrection against the Roman authorities in this year because of the census. So he knows about that. And I'm not sure he would have really confused different censuses when he has the knowledge here and he shows it. It's not a foolproof point, but it pushes me towards expecting that Luke might be way more right than he's wrong in Luke 2. So that means I think Luke is a historian, and he's basically a pretty good one, and he certainly has the benefit of doubt on his side. Now I'm jumping a little bit. I have some material which I'm just clicking through. It's all on your handout. The question is, how was the Roman Empire structured at that time? We had different kinds of provinces, depending on who was in control, the Senate or the Emperor, and what rank the governor had. Syria, that's important, was a province of the Emperor, and it was a consular province, a very powerful Roman magistrate with a lot of troops under his control. Herod's kingdom was a client kingdom. That means it was part of the empire, but it was governed by a local ruler because it was not civilized enough or not pacified enough for the Romans to bother with it. And the client kings had the job to make it good enough in order to make it a Roman province in the end. So to build cities, to build streets, to put on taxation, and in the end it was annexed. That's just good to know in order to understand what Quirinius was at the time. Then we have the Roman census. Two kinds of census are for citizens and two for the provinces, for non-Roman citizens who were inhabitants of the provinces. What Luke is describing is this kind of provincial census, and we don't know much about that, again, for the simple reason that ancient historians didn't like administration and didn't tell us a lot about that. What we know is mostly from Egypt, because we have a lot of papyri, tax declarations, taxation edicts, and other stuff. And we know that when a territory was made a province, there was a first initial census, and then there was a census every couple of years on a regular basis, but it was different in every province. And the Romans basically taxed two things, a poll tax, the tributum capitis, a head tax, a poll tax, where every person had to pay his taxes, and a land or property tax. There were the two basic forms of taxation, and that becomes important. Everyone was required to a place called Edea in the Egyptian papyri. That's the place for registration. That's usually where one was living, but not always. There were instances when people had moved away from their former place of living, but they had to come back because the administration was a bit slow and they were still registered at the old place of living, not at the new one. And that was maybe 14 or 20 years later. So it was expected to do some traveling, if necessary. Now we have the story about the census in Luke 2:1, the first problem. We do not know, and here Schürer is true, about any kind of empire-wide census under Augustus. just no evidence for that. We know that every province was taxed on its own, different kind of intervals, in a slightly different way. So the question is, does Luke claim that there was empire-wide census, a unified census? Most scholars say yes, and he's wrong. I'm not convinced that this is true. For the simple reason that this is not a secret esoteric ritual, it is just a tax declaration. You gotta pay your taxes, and everyone knew how this worked out. It was an everyday experience for every provincial citizen, or every inhabitant of the provinces. Even Luke may have paid his taxes roughly that way. And every reader of Luke must have realized that he's talking rubbish when he's claiming that there is an empire-wide census. What is true, though, is that all the data of the different provinces was collected in Rome, was analyzed in Rome, and Augustus wanted to have control over his provinces, over his empire. He wanted to know what money he could expect from different provinces. In that sense, it was an empire-wide measure, even though conducted in piecemeal in different parts of the empire. And if Luke was looking at this census just through the eyes of a provincial inhabitant and a peregrinus, how they were called, that's the normal way to talk about it. We have ample evidence from Egypt that even though a census was started by an edict by the governor, not the emperor, when people wanted to complain about being taxed unjustly, they wrote, well, based on the edict of the emperor, such and such, I had to pay the taxes, that was wrong, please correct that. So they knew that behind the governor was the emperor, and he's finally responsible for all of that, and he's collecting all the data in Rome, and it's empire-wide. So Luke may not speak with the precision of a modern constitutional scholar, but he's precise enough from the point of view of a peregrinus, an inhabitant of the provinces. There was the census, and it went throughout the empire, and the emperor was the one who kick-started it and who was responsible. Secondly, the problem is this journey to Bethlehem. Here's a quote from Joseph Fitzmyer, a Catholic New Testament scholar. He is certainly not a very, very bad critic of Luke. He's a good scholar, and actually it's a good commentary. But he writes, it's clear that the census is a purely literary device used by him, by Luke, to associate Mary and Joseph, residents of Nazareth, with Bethlehem, the town of David, because he knows of a tradition that Jesus was born in Bethlehem. Most scholars today think Luke or his sources invented the census in order to get Joseph and Mary to travel, because they knew the Messiah had to be born in Bethlehem, Old Testament prophecy, Micah 5:1. And so they had to get them to Bethlehem, one way or another. But in reality, Jesus was born in Nazareth. That's the majority view today. Over against this is at least two very simple observations. One, there were many messianic pretenders in early Judaism in the first century, up to Bar Kokhba in the second century, who was accepted as Messiah by the famous Rabbi Akiva. None of them claimed to have been born in Bethlehem. So they all claimed to be from a Davidic line. That was important. But birth in Bethlehem? No. And Micah 5 is always, or is never quoted as messianic prophecy in the kind of Jewish, early Jewish writings we know today. So I'm not convinced that this was truly important and that they had to get into Bethlehem. If he was born there, it might explain why Matthew puts an emphasis on it, because it fits nicely to Micah 5. But ex eventu, the expectation wasn't there. And secondly, a couple of years ago, a German classical scholar, Klaus Rosen, revived and substantiated an older theory by pointing to a newly discovered papyrus or is it parchment? Yeah, I think parchment, from Judea, which is a ancient tax declaration. So they had files and folders and kept it, and it was preserved in a cave at the Dead Sea from a Jewish woman called Babata from the year AD 127. It's on your source paper under number 7 if you want to have a translation of that. The funny thing is, on the one hand, when you put the text declaration next to Luke's Gospel, the first 7 verses of chapter 2, you almost think that Luke had this kind of formula in mind when he structured his story. It's precisely the same kind of structuring, so he must have known what he's talking about. And he told his story along the lines of an ancient Roman tax declaration. The second thing is, we have a married couple, Babata and her husband Jordanes. They had property in a certain district, not where they were living. So they had to travel to this district to be registered for their property. The wife, Babata, had a certain amount of property, but as a woman, she was not liabled, not allowed to do that on her own. She had to take her husband with her, who acted as a kind of legal guardian, and who filed her tax declaration for her. Under Roman law, women were not allowed to do that. So the woman was forced to travel because of land property, and the husband came with her to declare his own property and to act as guardian for his wife. This matches so closely the story told in Luke that I think that the theory makes sense that Mary and maybe Joseph too had some piece of property in or around Bethlehem. And when they were to be registered, they had to move to the south because of that piece of land. And Joseph went with Mary, had to go, pregnant or not, because it was her property and her land, and Joseph had to go with her once his wife was pregnant. I go with my wife too when she's pregnant. Two, because he had to act as her legal guardian. And three, maybe he had some kind of property himself. We don't know. With this parallel text, this parchment in mind, and with this background in mind, the story makes totally sense the way Luke tells it. There may be one objection, though. The simple point of every Christmas story, when it's retold in church at Christmas, what about the inn, the motel, where there was no room for the couple? If they had property, why were they looking for room to live or to stay during the night in an inn? Because that's the normal translation in most Bible translations. There was no room in the inn, the ancient motel. And here scholarship has actually made some improvement in our understanding. The word katalima, which Luke uses here for inn, does denote kind of a guest room. Your translation said that already, a guest room. When Luke tells about an inn in the story of the Good Samaritan, he uses a different word. I think Joseph was actually from Bethlehem. Luke says Mary was from Nazareth quite clearly, but not he doesn't tell us that about Joseph. And I think he may have been an inhabitant of Bethlehem. He just moved northwards, maybe to find work, maybe to get married to Mary. But I'm not sure that he was actually from Nazareth. So as a man from the house of David, he may have lived in Bethlehem or grown up in Bethlehem. On the other hand, here in verse 4, when Luke says he was from the city of David and the house and lineage of David, that's the point where in this tax declaration it says because he had property here and there. And so she had to go there. So it might be that Luke is phrasing this a bit differently in order to emphasize a theological point that he was from the house of David, which was important for the Messiah to be born from the house of David. When in a bit more secular way, he could have said because he was living in that town and had some land there. So he may just put it a bit differently to make a point. But that's certainly an objection that's valid. I'm suggesting that Luke is not to be read totally literally here, but that he is making a theological point, which is true. Joseph was from the house of David. He was from Bethlehem. But according to the form, he should have written because he had land there, where he's from. The inn. When Luke talks about a motel, he uses a different word, pandokeion. The only other place where he uses katalima is in the story of the Lord's Supper, when this is the upper room where Jesus and his friends meet for the Lord's Supper. And we do know models of... it's not here. You have it on your handout. We do models from first century houses. It was a one-room house, and at times there was upstairs a first-floor room, a guest room, a small one. It was called katalima. And I'm quite convinced that they're going back to the house of Joseph's family, but there is not enough place in the guest room where they were staying for giving birth to a baby, so they had to move to the main room. The main room was also used as a stable during the night. There were two levels in this main room, and in the lower level, there were the animals during the night. They couldn't run away, they couldn't be stolen, and they made the house warm. When at first daylight, they were just driven out of the house. The house was cleaned up, and there was the shop or the store of the house or place of the living room. So all Luke says is in the house of Joseph's family or maybe some friends, there wasn't enough room in the guest room for giving birth and for raising a little baby. So they moved to the main room. There were the mangers. There were the animals during the night. That's where they lived. But they had not to find room in a motel or an inn. In an ancient Near Eastern context, it would be unbelievable that a pregnant woman would have to move to a stable, a proper stable, in order to give birth to her first child. Even less so if there was family in the town. That's just not possible. That may be possible in a Western modern context, but not back then. So we do have the first two questions answered. Now there's the final question to be answered, and that's about Quirinius. Quirinius is a difficult case. I've given you part of the career we know. He was of a low background. He was a career military, a very good soldier, an accomplished soldier. And due to that, he made his way up to the highest levels of society. In the end, he even got married to the former fiancée of Augustus' grandson. He died. They never got married, and Quirinius got this young noble lady as his wife. That's as far as you can get with that kind of background. And he was one of Augustus' strongmen, one of his best soldiers and experts for administration, especially for the East. Whenever there was a problem in the East, Augustus sent him. We know a lot about him compared to other career militaries in the time of Augustus. We do not know enough about him in order to be sure when he was precisely around the time when Jesus was born. That's a bit of a bad thing. There are a couple of alternatives which we can look at when we want to know whether it could be that he was involved in the birth of Jesus. The first is Josephus could have misstated the census of Quirinius when he says it was AD 6. There was a notorious time. The son of Herod the Great, Archelaus, was dethroned. He was deposed by Augustus, and Judea became for the first time a proper Roman province. There was a major uprising of Jewish rebels against the taxation, the Roman taxation, and Quirinius conducted the census at that time. That's a story Josephus tells. The problem is that there are some points in Josephus' narrative which are far from crystal clear, and he's got some points where he seems to have a doublet, so he's telling the same story all over again, once in 4 BC, once in 86, when Herod died, when Archelaus was dethroned. And some scholars say that's evidence that he's wrong, he's misstated the whole thing. I wouldn't go that far. I think that's too skeptical a reading of Josephus, and I do not want to exonerate Luke by treating Josephus unfairly. But the problems are real, and the least I learn from that is that Josephus is not this kind of solid rock from which I can criticize Luke. He's got problems of his own. And if you're interested in them, I can give you a bit more details afterwards. They are substantial, these problems. The second alternative is Luke could be wrong. And for a historian, this is a valid alternative. And it's easy to see how this could have happened. There was a very, very well-known and even notorious census in 86 under Quirinius, and Jesus was born at the time of a census. But maybe the census 10 years earlier, when King Herod was still in power, in charge, but when his family remembered his birth, they somehow connected it with the popular one, the famous one, the notorious one. The one everybody remembered. And it could be that they just misdated his birth in this way. There was no actual absolute chronology at that time. You were dating events according to other famous events. So maybe his family got it wrong for about 10 years and told Luke the story and he just took it over. From the historian's point of view, this is plausible, and it makes a lot of sense. I'm still hesitant for two reasons. One is what we had before. Luke is pretty good in what he's doing. The second thing is, all we know is that Jesus' family was not among his disciples when he was alive. They were highly critical of him. James was not a believer. Certainly not. When he died and rose again in AD 30, probably, they suddenly are among the disciples in Jerusalem, in the church. Something must have happened to them. Paul says Jesus had appeared to James, the risen Jesus. This must have led to a reevaluation of everything they knew about this her famous son and brother. They must have gathered the stories again, retold them, reevaluated them. Couldn't we have seen that before, that he's the Messiah? We missed something for 30 years. And at that time, I think they must have also talked about his birth and the circumstances surrounding his birth. That was just 30 years later or 40 years later. It's not much time. So I think the traditions were fixed around AD 30, not 57, when Luke talked to James. And that's too close in time not to try to find another solution which might give Luke more credence. Then we have attempts to reinterpret Luke's text. Certain attempts to reinterpret his chronology. There are some scholars, Mark Smith, a British scholar, and Alexander Rubel, they're trying to argue that Luke is right. He's a good historian. He knows what he's doing. And he deliberately dates Jesus' birth to the year 86. Then it's a question, what about King Herod in Luke 1:5? And they say, well, that's Archelaus, his son. An impressive amount of evidence that any kind of ancient historian could have called him Herod, but not our historian in question. Luke mentions three Herodians, members of his dynasty, and he always gives the proper title. He's never wrong, never once. So why there? So I don't think this works. And then we have two more options left. One is that Quirinius was twice in Syria. Okay, yeah. That he was twice in Syria. Either twice as a regular governor, or once as a kind of special envoy, and once as a governor. The former solution was about the year 1900. The majority opinion in classical scholarship that Quirinius was twice regular governor in Syria based upon an inscription which you have on your handout, the Titulus Tibautinus, which unfortunately does not name the name of the guy mentioned there because the stone is damaged, and because of a war he waged in southern Turkey, where scholars said he must have been governor of Syria to do that, and that was sometime around 5 BC or so. The British scholar William Ramsay built up upon this consensus, a very impressive hypothesis, that Quirinius might have been in Syria around 7 BC as governor. And this was discussed very seriously for about 20 years. Then the evidence for this first governorship began to crumble. Other explanations for the evidence were much, much better and easier. And the whole idea of a twofold governorship disappeared from scholarship. And with it, Ramsay's pretty good and pretty interesting hypothesis. Unfortunately, in many very conservative evangelical apologetic works, this is still an option to be discussed and even to be preferred. If you stumble upon that, please do not believe that. It doesn't work any longer. I'm terribly sorry, but it's no longer a credible theory. On the other hand, it makes me humble because Ramsay did pretty good work. He did everything right, and still his theory is now on the rubbish dump of history. That can happen to me too. We're weighing evidence and we're painting a picture of the past. Another possibility is, and that's one of the main options, we know that Augustus at times sent special envoys, legati censitores, to provinces to make the tax registration. We have no idea why at times the governor did that and why at times this legatus censitor, but it was the case, obviously. And what Luke tells about Quirinius does fit not exactly, but pretty closely to what we know, to the little we know about those tax envoys, these special envoys. So it could be that Augustus, at a time around the year 7 BC, when Herod fell from grace, and when he was old and about to die, and Augustus even took away the title friend from Herod because they had a very serious argument, that he might have sent Quirinius as a special envoy to make a taxation registration in Augustus, in Herod's kingdom. One, as kind of a disciplinary action to show Herod who's the boss, the emperor in Rome, not the king in Jerusalem. And two, because the governor of Syria at that time was at pretty good standing with Herod. And Augustus may have decided to send somebody else who was not a friend of Herod, to make clear, hey, that's not a friendly measure. So realize, Herod, I'm the boss, you're not. That's a valid hypothesis. It does fit well to the time, to the context, as far as we know it. Unfortunately, we do know that much about those special envoys. And unfortunately, the case of Quirinius doesn't fit exactly to what we know. It's not 100% fit. And Luke, too, would be the only piece of evidence for that term of office of Quirinius in 7 BC in Syria. So it's not foolproof, but it's solid in my view. And the last option, and then I'm through, is a different kind of translation. I'll make it a bit short. It is possible to translate the sentence in chapter 2, verse 2, as this took place, this census took place either before Quirinius was governor in Syria, or with an ellipsis, this took place before the census when Quirinius was governor in Syria. This plays around with the possibility that Protos, the first, that's the word in the normal translation, it was the first census. In Koine Greek, it's a comparative. It can be used instead of a word called Proteros, and that's before, or the first of two. It's a bit like in English, in proper English, you would have to say the first of at least three. One, two, three. First, second, third. In proper Greek, you have to say protos and then at least second and third. Otherwise, you would say proteros, the former. In Koine Greek, that was gone. And we do have some evidence, for elliptical constructions. And if you look at the text below, that's the closest parallel we've got. The movement of the feet was found before Protos, Prote. That you have to add the movement of hands. It would work a bit like that. The good thing is, the interesting thing is, this revised translation actually works from the point of view of pure linguistics. The bad thing is it doesn't work 100% properly, because all our parallels are somewhat different in construction. There is missing a certain part of the construction in the Greek text here, which is a participle, a genitive absolute, and we do not have that in the other similar texts. So again, like with the special envoy, there is enough evidence to say it's plausible, it could work, but not enough to make it foolproof. I slightly prefer this option as maybe the least problematic of all. But the translation is a bit more cumbersome than the normal one. It's a bit more dodgy, a bit more... and the question is, am I willing to accept a slightly more cumbersome translation in order to make a good historian, a reliable historian, be right at this point? Or do I think I have to choose the smoother translation even at the cost of having him wrong at this point? So these are the options we have. Three options are there for Quirinius. Luke could have misdated the birth of Jesus for about 10 to 12 years. It could be that way, it doesn't have to be that way. Quirinius could have been in Syria before as special envoy, or we could translate Luke 2:2 with this before Quirinius. None of it is foolproof, but all of them are plausible and possible. That's as far as I can get. As a summary, I hope I was able to show that Luke as such, Luke 2 as such, is reliable history. Luke is a good historian. He told a credible story. He knew what he was talking about. And the substance of the story stands. The only problem is the dating. And here we have three options. Two of them allow Luke to be right. One of them claims that he's made a minor error. From the historian's point of view, this is good ancient history. And this is as far as I can get. So thank you very much. It took much longer than expected, but I hope it was still okay.